This week, it's two stories from Nightmares and Dreamscapes and Everything's Eventual, along with their videos from Nightmares and Dreamscapes. You know they got a hell of a band. And The Road Virus Heads North, live and direct from a rest stop just south of the world's biggest ball of twine in Cocker City, Kansas. And, wow, somebody needs to take a mower to the grass around this place. No kidding. Welcome to
The Dark Multiverse of Stephen...
Oh my god. It's the dark multiverse of Stephen King, okay?
Clinky clinky.
Cheers.
Yeah, this is our celebratory champagne for... Actually, this is our seventh episode.
Yeah.
We've actually done seven of these things already, and we're still doing them, and they're coming out every Monday.
And we're loving them.
So weird. Yeah, having a great time, but who'd have thought?
Mm-hmm.
And on iTunes and everything.
I know.
Like real people.
I was just going to say that. Real people.
So we've watched two of the episodes and listened to the audiobooks of two of the readings.
Right.
From Nightmares and Dreamscapes,
mm-hmm.
Which was a bunch of short stories, and they made eight of them mm-hmm. into episodes back in 2006 is when they finally made them. Anthology is much older than that, but name was too good, and they took these stories, and the two that we chose were you.
My pick was, you know, they got a hell of a band.
Yep, and mine was The Road Virus. Goes north?
Heads north.
Heads north.
That was it. I should have done this.
Yeah, that's right. Head. The Road Virus Heads North. And I thought it was real interesting because first the stories, which I remembered well but hadn't read in 1,000 years.
I love them both.
The audio versions that we read were kind of amazing.
They were super amazing. Mine was done by Gracie Slick.
Yeah, that's hard to believe.
It's crazy. I was like... And she did such a great job with the voices and with the, I mean, just everything.
And that
was
so weird because I would have thought, oh, stunt casting, you know, she's going to do it. It's not going to be very good.
Especially because it's about dead musicians.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'll just have Grace Slick do it. That'll be cool. And she's as good as anybody we've heard do the audio.
Yeah, I would say she's as good as like Michael C. Hall good.
Yeah, she did the voices, whoever directed her, or maybe she's just good at this. I'd actually love to hear her do more.
I want her to tell me bedtime stories all the time. That was so much fun.
She was great. And the other one was done by J.O. Saunders, who is a character actor you'd recognize from many things. Big, beefy guy. I don't actually know if he's done any Stephen King stuff before.
Right.
But he did this story, and he did a hell of a job.
It was really good.
Yeah,
I enjoyed both
really
those
strong.
Audiobooks. They were nice.
Yeah, and the other stories that are available are out there in a huge CD collection of 20 discs with various folks doing this. Everybody that does the story is different. We don't know how good all the rest are, but those two were excellent.
They were excellent. That was awesome.
We had, as usual, a hard time finding the older stuff. I ended up actually going to the local library and getting the audiobook in
CD
form.
That's right. I was surprised when you found it at the library. I didn't know they did that.
They
very
actually
cool.
have a ton of Stephen King.
Really?
So we'll probably be taking advantage of them again.
Yeah,
as we
let's
go
do that.
For one we don't have. But that was real nice. Yeah, here we are again. Just to remind you right up front that this is a full-time, no-exceptions, 24/7 spoiler podcast. We urge you to go reread or listen to the original stories from Nightmares and Dreamscapes and Everything's Eventual, and or grab a copy of the video adaptations before you listen to the rest of our meanderings, or risk your very sanity if you defy us. We're going to be talking about similarities and differences between print and video, and how good the audiobooks are, and celebrate some truly killer last lines, and we don't want to ruin anything for you, so do what you need to do and then return, enlightened and fully armed. We'll still be here. If you decide to stay, well then, don't say we didn't warn you. First, let's talk about, you know, they got a hell of a band.
I picked this story because I think there's something so demented that all of our old rock and roll heroes that they have out in the middle of nowhere, and only if you get truly, truly lost can you find rock and roll heaven. And they all live there, and it looks like Norman Rockwell, it looks like very 50s, and you know, they all have jobs, and Janis Joplin is working in a coffee shop as a waitress, and I mean,
when she's not puking up maggots.
Up maggots at people, or, you know, Buddy Holly when his eyes just tear blood. But it's horrifying to me, the idea that all the people that we love so much and fantasize about, like, oh, like Jim Morrison, that they're just all there and that they're so wicked and that they capture people like spiders and flies and pull them in. And once that band starts up, they can never leave, and they'll play for like a year, sometimes two. Time is different there. The city ordinance is done at midnight, so says the king himself, which is the mayor. And it's
and
so
they're
great.
Forced to listen. The few non-rock and roll stars are forced to listen to the music over and over
every
and forever.
Single night and forever. Yes.
Yeah. It's.
I like the end when the girl that's been there, she's like on drugs because they cut off two of her fingers for trying to warn the couple to escape. And she asks her in the book, she says, well, how old are you? And she says, 23. And she says, how long have you been here? And she says, I don't know, 10, 12 years, something like that. And she says, how old are you now? She says, 23.
Yeah, she hasn't aged.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. I have an interesting story about this story.
Okay.
It starts in a weird place. Way back in the early 1990s, I worked for a radio and music trade publication called Radio and Records. Now gone. It was very powerful. It was kind of like Variety for those guys, like The Hollywood Reporter or like Billboard. It was one of the rivals to Billboard. They had their offices in Los Angeles, and one of the guys I worked with was a fellow named Jeff Gelb, the best voice in the world. A former radio announcer, big rock and roll guy. He was in the sales department. I was doing other stuff there. And we got to be friends, and turned out we both loved comics and horror. And we ended up actually doing a column for a comic book magazine called Amazing Heroes way back then, too, for a year or two. And Jeff got this idea that he wanted to do an anthology of rock and roll horror stories, original stories.
Ooh.
And he was a gutsy guy, still is, still around, still doing stuff. And he contacted Stephen King through his friend Mick Garris.
Are you serious?
Mick actually worked for Radio and Records for about an hour and a half in there someplace. And Mick knew King. This is long before he did anything for him.
Right.
And he asked him, would he mind writing a story for it, never expecting he would actually do it.
That's how this got came to be?
And the story was in an all paperback edition called Shock Rock.
Uh-huh.
It was way back then. I think it was 92 that it was published. And King wrote the story.
That is so kick-ass.
And now here we are, you know, 10, 20 years later, it gets included in this.
That is so cool.
First in Nightmares and Dreamscape, and then it was included in that. But the story itself is kind of a one-off joke, in a way.
Right.
I mean, it's really kind of all predicated on the last line of the deal, rock and roll will never die.
And then she says...
You kind of riffs on that idea. If it didn't die, what would happen? Well, all these guys would have to go evil when they died. And where would they go? I would have thought they'd be in a big concert hall someplace. No, he puts them in a twisted Norman Rockwell town in the middle of nowhere. And
rock and roll will never die. And she says, that's exactly what I'm afraid of.
Yeah. So the story still holds together. And of course, he mentions all of these characters by name and all this music is playing and the rest. We see a lot of those characters in the adaptation, but not all of them.
Not all of them.
There's not really a lot of music in it. A couple of covers, because clearly getting the clearances for that would have been impossibly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they do a really creditable job of converting the story.
I think so, too. They did. They were very faithful to the story. It was almost line for line the same. I mean, there was a little bit different, but not much. I mean, it was good. I really liked it, and I thought it was super fun. I like how at the end of the show, Nightmares and Dreamscapes, that she takes control and she's like, we need to get out of here and that kind of thing. That wasn't in the book. She was kind of like, okay, whatever, I'm resigned to this. And her husband was the one that was like blanked out. In the show, he wants to stay. He's the only one clapping in the audience and he's like looking forward to the band playing for a year or 2 years each night.
Yeah, and that's interesting. About the only variation.
Mm-hmm.
It's religiously consistent with the story.
And I love it.
Wouldn't have known that if we hadn't read it just before we saw it. And I admit, I like Steven Weber in it. Steven Weber has gotten bad rap for his work.
He was horrible in The Shining. He was terrible.
Well, it wasn't his fault, but he was terrible in The Shining. And he did another King adaptation, so he was in Desperation.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. And I think he got
Yeah.
But this guy is a working actor all the time. He's in 1,000 things all the time, all the way from Wings 20 years ago till last
week. Well, the other guy
week.
In Wings was in Storm of the Century, and he kicked ass. He was really good at that.
Isn't that interesting? The two of them, both of them are doing Stephen King stuff. A lot of it. We talked about this, too, that as usual, King doesn't just have victims of these things. Especially that, you know, this nice husband and wife that go into a town and end up getting sucked into this horrible nightmare. In fact, he's kind of an asshole.
Yeah, he is.
Actually, kind of asks for it in a lot of different. He had a lot of chances to turn
wife,
around.
He's made a hostage to a fortune. You know, it's like he's taking her out in the middle of nowhere. There's no cell service, no power lines, and he just keeps wanting to press on and arguing with his wife when she's like
refusing to admit he's wrong and won't ask directions and do all that stuff. So to a degree, he kind of deserves it.
Yeah, but she doesn't.
But she doesn't, and she's the one that's going to be looks like stuck there forever.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out to be the other thing I want to say is that the production of Nightmares and Dreamscape was really very kind of high class. I mean, the production values were good.
I was impressed.
The music was done well. The people they had doing the lookalikes for the
characters looked like
really looked like a young woman playing, not so young woman playing
Pearl.
Janis Joplin was particularly good, but all of them, to one degree or another, it was kind of scary. And that was nice because that could have been so unpleasant.
That's very true, but it was really good.
Yeah, it was really good. Okay, I made a mistake in what I just said to Kat. Imagine me making a mistake. But here's the real deal. You Know They Got a Hell of a Band is, in fact, from Shock Rock, an original paperback anthology, first published in 1992, and then reprinted in Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which was published for the first time in 1993. But The Road Virus Heads North actually first appeared in Al Serantino's great original horror anthology, 999, in 1999, and then was republished in King's next anthology of short stories, Everything's Eventual, which was 9 years after Nightmares and Dreamscapes, in 2002. But both these adaptations appear in the 2006 video series called, just to confuse you completely, Nightmares and Dreamscapes. Sorry about all that. The audiobook versions for both can be found in the Audible editions of each of those collections, and they're both top drawer, no kidding. Getting the video collection legitimately is a little more difficult. It's not streaming anywhere at the moment, so you have to buy used copies of one or more of the 3-disc DVD series. The whole set, or individual copies, are available on Amazon and on eBay, and we have some links for that in the show notes over on www.darkmultipod.com. Thankfully, they don't have to be terribly expensive. You can get the whole set for around $15 if you look around a bit, but only as DVDs. There's no downloading anywhere. And the print and ebook versions of both collections are on Amazon and all the other major retail platforms. A new copy of the trade paperback will cost around $13 in each case. The ebook's about $11 each, give or take. And there are plenty of good quality hardcovers and mass market paperbacks for literally pennies, as low as 11 cents or 25 cents for Nightmares and Dreamscapes, and only a couple $3 for Everything's Eventual, though even Prime members usually have to pay shipping for those used copies. Still, super cheap and well worth it. Okay, let's get back to the jibber-jabber. Then the other one we watched was
The Road Virus
Heads North.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite King short stories.
It's so good.
And again, the audiobook version is real good, and it goes just as fast and as hard as I remember.
As we would read it yourself if you were actually reading it. Yeah, exactly. It's very good pacing.
And the other one we saw was...
They Got a Hell of a Band, did it straight by the book.
Yeah, absolutely by the book.
Story.
It was faithful to the story. This one was not.
And no, I don't know if it was an expansive thing. Do you know if Stephen King had any hand in writing?
Not that I know of. I do know the guy that wrote this, the screenwriter of this, was a really accomplished screenwriter. He wrote Flatliners. He wrote The Craft.
Wow.
He actually wrote two or three of the episodes of Salem's Lot, the TV versions.
Right.
Just before this. So he was well acquainted with it, I think.
Oh, that's good. It was interesting. I guess you couldn't do it in half an hour, 45 minutes, however long these are. It would be too short,
I guess you wouldn't be able to build up the suspense. One of the things that impressed me about re-listening to the story is how it is absolutely linear. It's basically one car trip from Derry to wherever he goes to visit his aunt and back home again.
No. He's coming from the convention in New Hampshire. So he goes to New Hampshire. He stops at his aunt's house on the way, and then he goes home.
Mm-hmm. And that's it.
And Derry.
And it's all almost real time in a sense, and that there's not a night that passes. There's not days that pass.
Right.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the story, yeah, I don't know that there was enough meat on that bone to do a full 45-minute thing. And the screenwriter, in this case, decided to add in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And some I'm still not sure about.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, so I know that you and I both had a problem with the fucking dogs. There was no reason to have dogs barking through the whole damn thing. Is that supposed to annoy you or make you scared? You know, it's like, I don't know. It just,
or is it because every time somebody evil goes near a dog, they go crazy?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or was it a reference to Cujo? Dogs.
I don't think so. I think it was just, I hate when they kill dogs. It's unnecessary, you know? And it was like, for him to even have a dog when he didn't in the book, it's just,
yeah, I didn't understand.
Dumb.
And it
yeah.
never paid off in any way.
No.
I mean, he picked up his dog and brought that dog home.
Right.
So, I mean, and that dog didn't have anything to do with the ending or anything.
No.
Just, that was a weird thing. The other thing was the inclusion of him being terminally ill.
Exactly. I don't understand. The only thing that I found interesting about that is at the end when the rotavirus shows up at his house, and in the book, he looks at the picture and he can see the car and the bucket seat is filled with blood, and he says, I think I'm going outside. I think with this show, they kind of did it that way so that it's like, oh, well, let's see how this goes, you know? But what I didn't like was when he had the conversation with the road virus. That made no sense at all.
And that last scene, mm-hmm. it was weird. There are three or four scenes in the adaptation that mm-hmm. are word for word from the story.
Right.
His conversation with his aunt mm-hmm. is exactly as it was. And that very ending, not falling down the stairs, but his last, the guy rolling up, opening the car door, mm-hmm. pointing to it, him saying, I think I'm going outside.
Yeah.
That's the end of the story.
But in the show, do you think it's him kind of accepting this fate of us knowing that he's got some kind of a terminal illness?
Yeah,
I mean, it was like
him getting into the car and saying, you're my disease, we're tied together, and basically
that was dumb.
The road virus says, no,
like
I'm not.
That. Yeah.
No, I'm not.
No, I'm not.
That's completely
this has nothing
not
to
it.
Do. Don't be projecting.
The ego, he says.
Ego,
which is actually,
yeah.
But it's like, that's not what this is about. It seems to me a pretty straightforward story of a guy mm-hmm. who happens to be a horror writer
mm-hmm.
buying a haunted painting.
Yeah,
the spirit of which stalks him and ultimately catches him.
Yeah, we don't know if he dies or not, but
right, and whether it absorbs him and takes mm-hmm. him out of the car or kills him and whatever.
Yeah.
But that it didn't just stalk him; it captured him.
Yeah.
Found him.
It was so good.
And along the way,
great.
He's killing mm-hmm. people off, anybody he talks to or touches.
Yeah, anybody he stops with. And I think the only way that Aunt Trudy, his aunt, didn't get killed was because he burned the painting. Maybe the road virus didn't know where he went.
And he had her go away. That is,
the beheaded woman.
Yeah. She was in the same place where he bought it.
So that's true.
He kind of just followed that same mm-hmm. road that he had followed.
Yeah.
But since Aunt Trudy had gone off to Kennebunk, she wasn't there to get killed,
murdered,
but everybody
right.
else in the way just coming for, was it Richard Kimmel?
Yeah, or Richard Kinnell or something
Kimmel,
like that.
And what I like too is that in the story, King talks about this guy's two books,
uh-huh.
which I suspect we'll find next time we visit Page Turner's. But
exactly.
But he names them both, and he gives terrible quotes from reviewers saying, "Vomit up this next piece of track or whatever." And you know that's King just riffing on
exactly all of the critics that he had back in the day,
and still does. People that still think it's work.
Ridiculous.
You know, some years ago he won the National Book Award. A ton of people said, "How dare you give a crappy little pulp writer this big literary award?" And he thought it was funny. But there are still people that think he's doesn't deserve all the money
about
he's made
it.
Or whatever. But yeah, I think the screenwriter's attempt was to enrich the story,
mm-hmm.
but it also made it much more confusing.
Yeah.
And things that didn't pay off, like the dogs, like seeing the really creepy fans at the beginning.
Yeah, that was totally unnecessary too. But the only funny part of that was is that they asked the questions that Stephen King hates the most, which is, do you scare yourself and where do you get your ideas from? And so that was amusing, but it was unnecessary.
We'll never know, but I wonder if the screenwriter sat down with King and said, if you were going to blow this up, if you
mm-hmm.
were going to expand mm-hmm. this and do more with it, what about? And then they added
right.
in this stuff. But it all comes off a little bit like window dressing, like padding.
It does.
When I almost would have preferred this to be part of like a movie anthology mm-hmm. where each segment can be as long as it needs to right. be rather uh-huh. than an episodic show where right. it has to be 47 minutes.
That's true.
Because we got a lot of stuff in here that...
Like you said, it's filler, it's fluff.
Yeah, but at least they didn't change the fundamentals
yeah.
of it.
They didn't change the last lines. That was the most yeah. important thing that I really, really liked about the adaptations was that they didn't change the last lines because those last lines are, in his short stories, that's what gut punches you in the mm-hmm. best way possible that you're just like, oh, yes, I needed that.
And it's funny because much of what King does happens in your head, mm-hmm. you know, the fear and stuff, right. even though a lot of it is very outside and pulpy and vampires and everything. But these stories in particular, they weren't chosen because they'd be easy to adapt.
Right.
And the production values on all of these episodes are really good.
They've
got
good.
Solid actors in it, like Marsha Mason and Tom Bergeron.
Yeah.
These are guys that did a lot of good work.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't skimp on anything to make these things back in 06. They stand up real well.
They do.
By looking at all of the horror mm-hmm. anthologies that are being done now and the quality of those things.
Oh, yeah.
This thing still holds up.
And yes, this was King at his, like, I mean, and I love Nightmares and Dreamscapes so much because it's got so many goofball stories in it, too, you mm-hmm. know? So I really like that collection. It's got some stuff that's really terrifying and some stuff that's just kind of hilarious and scary and spooky.
Well, that's what I feel about mm-hmm. Hell of a Band. I think this is just like a joke.
It.
You start with the joke of... What mm-hmm. if all rock and roll stars were horror monsters?
I just think it's creepy and freaky and just like, oh my God, you know, and that they're all not nice people, especially the ones that were the nicest ones or the meanest ones now.
That one kept your attention the mm-hmm. entire time.
It
Things
does.
Got a little wandery in the road virus. And
yeah.
A little bit. What's this about? Why are we doing that?
Why,
to,
yeah.
Didn't just get me to the end. Mm-hmm. A couple of times, I think both of us kind of were checking our watches to say,
exactly.
move this along. And it would have been way better at 25 minutes than at 45
I think
minutes.
So as well. And they even had the picture moving while you're looking at it, which was something that did not happen in the story. You know, it's every time he looks at it, something changes, or he destroys it and it comes back and it's changed. So I thought, you know, again, if they were going to do that, that would have been fine. If it would have been shorter, just show us the, you know, continuation of how it's constantly changing. Just keep showing it, keep showing it. We don't need to know about your cancer.
Well, it was a challenge to take that story and try to make it into a motion picture at all.
Yes, I'm actually very surprised that they chose that one. I'm glad that they did.
And I think given that, I think this was a valid sort of solution to the problem
mm-hmm.
of trying to make this into a good adaptation. It just wasn't nearly as satisfying, and strangely doesn't stand up nearly as well as the rock and roll story. Well, I expect it to be the other way around.
Yes, exactly.
And there are six more of these things, and in future mm-hmm. we're going to come back and listen to the audio for those and watch those as well. In the meantime...
Because Crouch End is on there, and that's a good one. That's one of my favorites.
Actually, I think all of them to one degree. Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be interesting to see. I think a couple of them we both think, but it's been
mm-hmm.
probably
it's been
10
enough.
Years
yeah.
since I've actually watched these things, and that long, or more than that, since I've read the story.
True.
So we'll be back on both of these.
We will.
Okay, well, here's to here's to us.
Here's to us.
What's coming up in the next edition of Inside View? Were aliens discovered in Haven, Maine 30 years ago? What really caused the famous Overlook Hotel to explode way back in 1997? And whatever happened to that center-spread, wife-beating, bad boy, best-selling novelist, Johnny Merrinville? Did he really disappear into the Arizona desert, or is he somewhere else? Learn it all in the next edition of Inside View, where ace reporter Richard Dees almost gets that interview with disgraced presidential candidate Greg Stilson that he's always wanted. And we share the secret cure for insomnia that the AMA has been hiding from us for years. Spoiler alert, it involves big scissors and a yellow coat. Seriously. Inside View, the tabloid that brings you the real story behind the stories. Look for it in your nearby Red Apple convenience store and learn what's really going on. Okay, let's talk about all of the multiverse and metaverse connections of Castle Rock Episode 6, The Filter.
It's a pretty light week for multiverse references, but here are a couple.
We actually go into the grounds of the Juniper Hill Asylum for the first time, but not for long because actually the place starts burning down almost before we know it. As we said last week, Juniper Hill is mentioned in a ton of King books, from It to The Dark Half to Bag of Bones to The Tommyknockers. It's even in 11-22-63.
Oh, I love that one.
It's a very popular place. But you know, we never go inside. As far as I know, we never have been.
Oh, my God.
We even just got into the yard, and he said, this is your new patient. You have another name for him. Just
so we have no idea what happens inside. In fact, I think in the original miniseries, It is the only time that we don't actually see inside. We see the outside when Pennywise turns into the moon and is talking to Henry.
Yeah, talking to
and he's trying to tell him, kill them all, kill them all.
Yeah. And all we see is like his room in the asylum.
See out the window. Yeah. So yeah, that's basically it.
Very mysterious place.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
I'm kind of curious to explore it. The greatest meta connection this week is the casting of Henry's son, Wendell. He's played by the wonderfully named Chosen Jacobs, who plays Mike Hanlon in the remake of It and will reappear in the 2019's Chapter 2 of It.
Yeah, that's very cool. And speaking of wonderful names in general, the actor playing the wonderfully named Odin Branch at the end of this episode is, in fact, an accomplished deaf actor named Charles Jones. That's legit American Sign Language that he's using throughout, by the way. His assistant, Willie, who is played by Rory Culkin, does a pretty good job of interpreting the ASL, though he does occasionally get ahead of the signs, which is a pretty common problem. And I just love his last line, which is, not deaf, perfect.
Oh, I love watching you sign when you do that. Oh, Brad is so good with sign language. I love it.
I'll sign that in an Instagram.
Yes, you should. I agree. Yeah.
So that's it. Very short this time around, but not a whole lot going on in episode 6, Filter.
Mm-hmm.
And next week we'll be back with number 7. And that about does it for, you know, they got a hell of a band from Nightmares and Dreamscapes and Nightmares and Dreamscapes and The Road Virus Heads North from Everything's Eventual and the video of Nightmares and Dreamscapes. Confused yet? One more time, you can get further details as well as links to the King stuff and Jeff Gelb's Shock Rock and Al Sorrentino's 999 over on the show notes on www.darkmultipod.com. The same place you can drop us a note to tell us how incredible we are or what idiots we've become, and so quickly. We're waiting to hear from you. You can follow us on Instagram, where we continue as @DarkMultipod, and on Twitter, also as @DarkMultipod, and we will kiss you square on the lips. Hi, McElroy Brothers. If you subscribe, rate, and review us over on iTunes, where such things actually do matter, believe it or not. Our theme music and bed music still emanates from the wonderful artist, writer, composer, podcaster, and performer Chrysanthi Tan, and we insist that you visit her at chrysanthitan.com and join her growing community of brilliant supporters over on Patreon at patreon.com/chrysanthitan. She's not hard to find. That's Chrysanthi like chrysanthemum and Tan like the color I can't get no matter how much I spend time outdoors, even in the summer. You can also Google her, which is probably actually the best way all around. You can find Brad's books on Amazon under Brad Munson. That's my name, don't wear it out. And or follow him on Twitter as @TheBradMunson or on Instagram under that same egotistical rubric. And if you continue to harbor the illusion that you'll ever find Kat Bentley Shaikh lurking on social media, just give that up. She's harder to catch than a cat dancing on an ice floe or a baseball rolling down a water slide. Only fools and fanatics are going to try that. Just contact her through darkmultipod@gmail.com, and I promise she'll get the message. Cross my heart and hope you die. That's it for this week. Stay away from drafts and holes in the floor, and come back next week for another episode where we'll be discussing... wouldn't you like to know? Check the social media. We'll always spill our guts there. In the meantime, all you kids get off of my lawn. Very classy. Very pro.
I think it's just PJs. Hold on. Loosen it up in the chest area. Okay.
My favorite area.
My favorite. Mine too.
Yeah.